Welcome to the Mockingcast, the podcast of Mockingbird Ministries, an organization that exists to connect the Christian faith with the realities of everyday life. As always and ever, I'm Scott Jones, and we come to you every Friday.
Wait a second, Scott. This isn't Friday.
It's not Friday, is it? It's actually Monday.
This is the first day of the week.
Yeah, it's Monday. So what are we doing? Why are we doing a podcast on a Monday?
Well, because I hold in my hands the brand new issue of The Mockingbird. Issue number 8, fall 2016, the mental health issue. It's our longest issue. I dare say it's our best and our most beautiful issue of the magazine. And we are coming to you today to feature it and highlight it and shove it down your throats.
It is really a beautiful periodical. It's a beautiful, it's gorgeous, and it's chock full of content. David, give us some of the highlights. Just run down quickly. What can people be excited about? What can they expect?
Oh, man. Well, first of all, the artwork is incredible, as it always is, but that it sort of deserves a shout out of its own. We have an interview with Heather Havrileski, sort of one of my favorite writers, who also is a advice columnist. We have an interview with Brian and Debbie Solom, who've had the trial and real drama of faith testing drama of raising someone who's been diagnosed as a sociopath. We have articles about medication and depression and suicide, but also about self-justification. We get to interview one of my favorite social scientists ever, Carol Tavris, who is a wrote the book Mistakes Were Made But Not By Me, all about self-justification. Scott, we have something from you about Frank Lake and the schizoid self. We have I could just keep going. It's incredible. My sister-in-law, Bonnie Poonzal, talks about attachment theory and as it relates to God. We have an interview with Alistair McGrath's wife, the incredibly talented Joanna Calicut, about assurance as it plays out sort of theologically and psychologically. We have a great sort of first-person account of working at a she calls it a funny farm as a joke, and then Will McDavid weighs in with a how to cope with the modern world, a short guide. In the midst of it, there's poems from Gray Jakobik, who is she's just an incredible poet. Lots of lists that are funny as well. I mean, we do one list that I like, especially called Cures of Yore, which sort of goes down through sort of what mental health diagnoses and prognoses, in fact, from like ages past, and really funny stuff and also alarming stuff from throughout history. We go through books we're reading. We go through not the best non-self-help books. I can't recommend this thing more highly. I think it's thick. It's thick. It's beautiful. I'm holding it in my hands for the first time today. And I'm just so proud. I'm so stinking proud.
David, how does this fit into who Mockingbird is? Like, why a print magazine? You know, especially in the digital age, like, why do a print magazine?
Well, I mean, there's a few reasons. I think not a lot of people don't read websites, or they're sort of the older generation, but also the younger generation. Increasingly, people get their information or their thought, life, their spiritual fuel from other places. But I think it was a way to feature longer pieces we were writing, to something that was felt a bit more permanent. I think all of us are big fans of the artifact. You know, I collect vinyl records, and so I love actually holding something in my hand. And I think that putting enough time and effort and care into something that you can put on your bookshelf, even in a today's, like, is a bigger privilege. It's also a risk. It's kind of countercultural. But I think it delivers, it kind of sums up, these things function as mini books, in fact. We were thinking about doing mini books for a while, sort of, hey, what is Mockingbird thinking about? What are our writers, our constituents? What are we thinking about social media? What are we thinking about forgiveness? Where are we on, technology these days? And so these aren't terribly timely. I mean, they're timeless, hopefully, although there is some current stuff in there. I want them to stand as sort of an ever increasing kind of compendium of what thought and where we are right now with how do we integrate the message of the gospel and the message of grace with a specific theme. And that's sort of how it fits in, but also really trying to do something that's excellent, which is, you can do now with a small staff and not a lot of money in a way that you couldn't do in the past.
By the way, Harry Connick Jr. just came out, I forget, maybe it was on his show, and said that vinyl is overrated. So just for the record. So, yeah,
well, when you move houses, it's a big liability. That's for sure.
And to get the print magazine, people can just go over to our website. Right.
Well, they're actually have a yes, you can get through the website, but we have a special specialized website for the magazine, magazine.mbird.com, and you can buy individual issues, you can subscribe, and then you can also sign up to give to support Mockingbird monthly, even as little as $5 a month, which is what a ton of people do. Thank God, it's really one of the ways we keep going, and then you automatically, if you give, you know, $5, $10, $15, $20, you know, $1,000 a month, you can, you'll automatically get whatever we got coming out. And so that's how you do it.
David, thank you. And I hope that our listeners will grab a copy of the most recent magazine, The Mental Health Issue.
# Ethan Richardson is my hero.
In addition to being David's hero, Ethan Richardson, the editor-in-chief of the magazine, is also my next conversation partner. Back on the special edition of the Mocking Cast, EZE, I call him, Ethan Richardson, the editor in chief of Mockingbird magazine. It doesn't say editor in chief on the table of content, like introduction thing. Are you indeed the editor in chief?
I am the editor in chief, and don't let anybody else tell you different.
Why is David the publisher?
I don't know. I think Dave just wanted credit in some way.
It's like if people want to produce the production credit on a film.
Yeah, it's a meaningless title. Dave has nothing to do with this. It's all me. I get all of the glory.
Self-justification. So, okay, here's like my question. So you are an editor of a print magazine. Is that like a retro calling?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I was telling someone the other day, like, especially working for Mockingbird, which spends so much of its energy online and sort of doing the day in and day out of blog posting and podcasting. It doesn't feel like cool retro. It feels like lost in the abyss retro, because you're working on this project for, you know, 4 months or 3 months, and you're not getting a whole lot of feedback on the work that you're doing, but you feel like you're putting something together that's worth it. And then at the end of the 3 months, you know, you throw this thing out there and you hope that people bite, you know.
So what you're saying is the mental health issue of the magazine eroded your own mental health.
Yeah, I've gone completely insane.
Well, that's sometimes that's good for an artist. A little bit of an edge. So tell me, what are you most, I mean, you have some big name contributors in this edition of the magazine. Who are you? What are you most excited about? What should our readers jump to as this comes in their mailboxes?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's all the familiar faces, you know, there's the Zeitgeist himself, who's writing about suicide. There's the podcaster himself, Mr. Scott Jones, writing about Frank Lake.
Indeed, I am featured in this issue, which is very, it was a thrill to write.
Yeah. And then, as far as folks that we've talked to, you know, Scott, you did an interview with Joanna Collicutt, who's a psychologist and a minister in England and
very British.
So British. And then we also have Heather Haverleski, who is one of our mocking heroines. She just put out the book, How to Be a Person in the World, and she also does the Ask Polly column for New York Magazine. She's such a big deal. It was so cool to have her in there. And then we also have someone else that we continually refer to is this book by Carol Tavares and Elliot Aronson about self-justification. Mistakes were made, but not by me.
Who will later hear on this podcast?
Right. Yeah, I'm so excited. So those are kind of just some of the big names, but I tell you what, the issue is so chock full of good content that it really doesn't matter who's you're reading. It's just amazing.
Do you like cold call people? I mean, how do you get contribute? How do you solicit contributions?
For the most part, we either go with stuff that from the website we've really loved. Like that's how we reached out to Heather and to Carol. But honestly, it's been kind of a Holy Spirit thing each time, where either we get submissions that are too good to not include, or we just feel like someone's perfect for the job, and so we reach out to them. And so each time it's really worked out. This one in particular has been amazing.
Is it like a pregnancy? Like, are people like me who are like, you know, last minute submitters and everything? Are you like, is this thing going to be born? Is it like, you know, I'm hoping for 10 fingers and 10 toes kind of, is there that sort of a feeling as to things coming together?
Yeah. And it's funny because, you know, there's so many steps to the process, which I'm sure is like a pregnancy, where like, you know, you go through the process with the actual writers, and then you're going through the process with the editors, and then you're going through the process with the art people. And by the time the proof is ready to be picked up at the print shop, it's like, I don't even want to look at the thing. It's been in me for so long that I'm just ready to get it out. So
I'm sure all the pregnant women and women who have given birth in our audience love us, our comparisons and analogies. I'm sure those are just greeted with warmth and fuzzies. And you wrote a really interesting piece called Overmedicated, Under God, Help in the Age of Antidepressants.
Yeah. So one of the things that is kind of a recurring theme in the issue is kind of in the age of medicine, in the age of science, you have a growing understanding of pathologies and diagnoses that that are ever expanding. And so the things that we used to think were just quirks that people had or illnesses that people had are suddenly medicalized. You know, they have definitions, and they have ways that we can talk about them. But what also happens is there's a limiting factor there too, right? I mean, there's a way that we begin to understand ourselves as really just, you know, anatomical cells. And you take a certain chemical, and those cells reproduce in a healthy way or in an abnormal way. And you get really close with all of these essays. What happens is when you're talking about science, and especially the science of the mind, you end up getting very close to talk about the soul or what our internal life is like. And as much as we want to take medicine for aches and pains and external injuries, it's something totally different to talk about the internal ones. You know, we get very afraid, and there's a lot of stigma with talking about illness of the mind.
I love how you conclude your piece. You say grace is offensive no matter who you are, but to the over-medicated pill popper, to the willful self-helper, to the mother who needs all the help she can get, the grace of God will always be the best medicine. It remains all we ever need, even if we still need the pills.
Yeah. I mean, I just, as someone who, you know, I've been medicated, I've been on antidepressants off and on for the last 10 years of my life. And especially in Christian circles, there's a sense that weakness is allowed, but only in sort of the victimized sense of weakness. Internal weakness looks a little bit too much like a lack of faith or a lack of sort of inner grit. And what I'm trying to get at in the essay, and what I hope the rest of the magazine gets at, is the fact that mental illness is just another way that we are weak, you know, and also therefore just another way that Jesus is present to bring us healing.
Ethan, you're a treasure in a clay jar, and so is this issue of the magazine. Thanks for all your hard work on it.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. I hope everybody enjoys.
Next, we'll hear from Carol Tavris, who's the co-author of Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me, and who is interviewed in this issue of the magazine. Welcome to the podcast for the first time.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So there's a scene in The Big Chill where Jeffrey Goldblum's character says, a human being can live without food or go a day without food or without sex, but we can't go a day without a good rationalization. If Aristotle says we're rational animals, your reissue of your book called Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me, of course, might assert with Goldblum that we're really just rationalizing animals, right?
Well, you know what? That's Elliot Aronson's great line, which he's been saying for many years since his work on cognitive dissonance. We are the rationalizing animal. And that's absolutely so, because meaning and consistency are so important to how we function every day. We don't stop to question why it is we're doing everything we do and why we think what we think, but it's a very efficient system to be able to rationalize what we do and what we believe without having to stop and argue with ourselves about it. Should I be brushing my teeth this morning? You
know? or let alone floss.
Yeah, floss, how about that?
So there was this commercial, I guess in the 80s, it was a public service announcement. Remember, it was this is your brain. It was like a pan. And then the egg would start dropping it and fry and said, this is your brain on drugs. Any questions? So if we were doing this is your brain on cognitive dissonance, how would the commercial look?
How would the commercial look? Let's see. Well, your brain in a state of consonance would be blissed out on a beach in Hawaii, you know, having a nice pina colada and really feeling sunshine. Your brain on dissonance would be very jangled. You would be, what would the image be? You know, teetering from the top of a mountain and wondering if you're going to get down safely. Dissonance is really uncomfortable. That's the fascinating thing about it. When we may not even be aware of it because we go along rationalizing before we're aware that we're even uncomfortable about an idea. We do that by just pushing the idea out of awareness so that we don't have to deal with it.
Do you, like, when you go to, like, cocktail parties at friends' houses, do they, like, see you and, like, scurry to the corner because they're like, no, she's going to put me in a state of dissonance. She's going to question all my self-justifying delusions. I'm just going to have another
one. That's right. Scott, I can tell all of yours immediately, even long distance here on this podcast. Oh, look out behind you. I see something you're trying to cover up. Right. No. No. You are, I'm afraid, worried. You have what we call the fear of psychologist worry, which is that somehow you can see into your mind at all times. Just what you're thinking, you nasty person. Right? No. But I'll tell you something. Actually, in seriousness, it's a really interesting question, because my friends we often do find ourselves talking about ideas that we need to change, or beliefs that we have to give up, whether they're scientific views of something or personal ones or perceptions of our family members. And it's really helpful to know when we are trying to resolve dissonance in an unhealthy way.
Yeah, friends are like, good friends are like mirrors sometimes, right? They help you. Jonathan Haidt, in his work, says that morality binds us together. It binds and it blinds.
Yes.
You have a kind of related phrase in your work called believing is seeing. Why is believing seeing?
Right. Well, we usually think, you know, seeing is believing. If I see something, I see somebody commit a crime in a store, and I see it as evidence of my own eyes, and it must be true. But what we know from psychological research is that our eyes aren't always good witnesses. What we see is often contaminated and distorted by what we believe we are seeing. This is very, very hard for people to accept. We think there's something, you know, like the eyes are a camera. We're just accurately recording everything that's happening. But all we have to do is look around what's happening in our country today with so many scenes of violence. Look at Black Lives Matter, where the whole essence of the dilemma is that police and non-police are seeing the same situation differently based on the beliefs they have going into it. That's why what we believe has such a powerful influence on what we see.
Yeah, it seems to me, okay, from your work, right, if I am, well, one of the two things. First of all, it made me think that there's this old adage, right, that, you know, somebody has to be finished last in medical school. You know, somebody's got to be the worst student. Your work almost makes me think I want the person that finished last because maybe they won't have such a high view of themselves and they'll be more open to watching for mistakes and that stuff. I'm like, you know, if the person was third in medical school or something, now I have apprehension. You know?
Well, you know what? You're right in a way, because what the research shows is that very often it's the people who have the highest self-esteem, who are the most confident, who are the most arrogant that everything they do is right, who find it hardest to accept evidence that they screwed up, you know, whether it's in medical school or law or any other profession that there is. And it's why, I mean, you know, the stories in our book that doctors who see themselves as good, caring, compassionate, wise people, I could never make such a mistake. I could never, you know, willingly, you know, harm a patient, and that they don't believe they could. But it's crucial for all of us to be able to say, I made a mistake. I did something really wrong here. Now, what can I do to learn from what I did wrong in a way that allows me to still see myself as a good, competent person, but one who, in this case, made a mistake? I heard a wonderful story, actually, by a physician who did a biography of Virginia Apgar, the woman who lent her name to the Apgar score, which is given to newborn babies on how they're, you know, doing physically and so on. And she was a tremendous medical student. She had, as a resident, she was working on a surgery with her senior physician, and she made a mistake. She clamped an artery. Well, she didn't know that if she made this mistake or not. The patient died in surgery. And later she said to the main physician, did I do this? Did I clamp the wrong artery and cause this patient's death? And he said, you know what? Let it go. There's nothing that can be done now. Patient died. It's a tragedy. These things happen. Just get on with your life and continue. But she couldn't stand not knowing. She had to know. And so she went to the morgue and looked at the autopsy and found that she had, in fact, been responsible for that patient's death. Now, I mean, she had to know so that she would become a better doctor, so that she would not make that mistake again. And you think of the guts it took to be able to do that investigation to say, gee, could I have been wrong? In order to make yourself a better person, a better doctor.
That's an amazing story.
Isn't it?
If what your research tells us is true, which I take it to be, I mean, it looks like a very legit book here. When we make moral decisions, all right, like, so if I make a decision, you know, a personal one, or if I'm making one in public life, right? The moment I make that decision, I'm going to start looking for, I'm going to read, I love how you call memory the personally biased, like historian of our mind. They like writes the story that we want to hear all the time. So like, it seems to me like if I make a decision that's ambiguous, I'm going to start justifying, you know, the decision. And it's going to dispose me more to making a similar ambiguous, you know, moral choice. And so down the road, it's very easy to just become a dreadful person with no sort of moral sensitivities, it seems.
You nailed it, Scott. That is exactly the process. You know, the example we say in our book, you know, how do you corrupt a good man. You just get him to take one tiny step off the pyramid in making a decision toward how you want that person to behave, and self-justification will do the rest. That was what happened in the Watergate scandal, for example. But you know what? We see that with the Volkswagen scandal, you know, the diesel engines. We see it with the Wells Fargo people. Nobody starts out saying, let's see what kind of plan I can come up with that will rip off millions of people and that will deceive our customers and that will cause us to put a dreadful drug on the market that's not harmful. And it's okay. Nobody starts off thinking that way. What they do is saying, what can I do to maximize my profit here a little bit with this drug? Because that's good for the, you know, that's good for people. You know, this might be a really good drug. You put a lot of money into the drug, a lot of money. And now the evidence starts building that maybe your drug isn't so helpful. You know, gee whiz, maybe people's legs fall off. Well, listen, they have another leg. They don't need two legs. and so it's sort of step by step. You can get people into really deep moral compromises that they might never, ever have imagined themselves in. Because then it's very hard to get yourself out of that hole and say, you know, for me, the corruption began a long time ago when I first agreed to do that little thing. Yeah? And we justify it and keep going.
I think you would probably make a great, like, dating personal life coach, right? Or I would love to see you like as featured on like The Bachelor. Like, don't, no, you're just, you know, you're self-deluded. You're crafting the right knife. You're picking the wrong woman or you're picking the wrong guy. Like you would be, I would love like a spot with you on those shows. Cause I think that the results would be much better for the contestant. Do you give like dating advice to your friend? Have you been like a person that's given a lot of